Good morning. Today is Tuesday, April the 3rd. Joining us this morning is meteorologist in charge of Whidley Island, Troy Nicolini. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Well, I'm not in charge of the entire island.
Yeah. Well, you're at the gateway, so...
We are the first building on the
they
left.
They have to pass your place to go anywhere else.
It's true. And we often get people coming in looking for the Corps of Engineers or the Harbor District. Yeah, and so we actually made up a map that says, you are here, and then I can draw a squiggly line to whatever they're looking for. The Coral Sea, for example, or the Whidley Island. The Cafe Marina. So, yeah,
so
we give directions.
So put a little sign out there. We're not who you're looking for. Go that way.
But we might be.
Yeah. Well, with those folks, they'll see through the BS.
Yes.
Or I guess it would be FS, huh? Fish instead of bull.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, last week you had the annual pay attention test. Did all the sirens go off and all the bells and whistles jingle?
So there's a couple of sirens that we knew wouldn't go off because we had done a preliminary test beforehand. Called a growl test. You basically just see if the motor will start to turn and then immediately turn it off. So it sounds like a growl because it starts to spin up and it kind of goes, and then
It's like the fire engine that doesn't.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, and those ones all are pretty much right on the coast and being exposed to incredibly corrosive saltwater spray year round. And they're proving to be very challenging to keep functional. So that's something. And when I say we.
Aren't all of them?
Not necessarily. For example, the one on Whidley Island is close to the zone, but it's back from the ocean a little bit. So,
you're talking about actually like getting sprayed from.
Well,
the
there's a different amount. There's different degrees to which you can get saltwater corrosion impact. And on windy days with big surf, sometimes you'll see this when you drive to Trinidad. There's like a kind of a misty looking haze right around the surf line.
Yeah,
and that's waves that are actually tossing saltwater in the air. And then it blows on shore, and so like that is really corrosive. And then if you're half a mile or a mile back, you still get some of that, but not as much.
You don't get the smell.
Yeah. So the ones that are right, like Clam Beach is right on the beach. It's very problematic. So
do you have one at the lagoons?
There's one at Big Lagoon, okay. and one at Trinidad. So and they're not everywhere. And some of the feedback we get is that I didn't hear a siren, and so sometimes that's because people live in Cutton, and so. Now, some people in my world would say, okay, the sirens are kind of causing us more trouble than good because people really want a siren and they get confused when they don't hear a siren. But my view is that, and many of my colleagues, is that they seem to start conversations more than any other warning device. And so it's a great opportunity to say, where do you live? Oh, I live in Cutton. Well, here's why you didn't hear a siren. You're at high ground. You have no exposure to tsunami threat.
Don't worry.
So don't stress about it. And people are often like very relieved to hear that because it until that moment in time, they didn't know that. They thought that the tsunami was going to get them, in Cutton even most of Eureka is out of the zone.
What has been the tallest wave? Go back at 200 years, right?
So Professor Dangler is a person who remembers all those numbers off the tip of her tongue. And for some reason, I just don't have that skill.
Ballparky,
but I can tell you
a 10-foot wave.
Well, no, much bigger. So there's different sources of tsunamis, and the one that is the source that's most common is an earthquake that happens under the seafloor, and that's the one that caused the big tsunami in Japan in 2011 that also impacted our coast. That mechanism is what's caused the big tsunami in Alaska in 1964 and in Chile in 2010 and Indian Ocean. So that's that source of tsunami tends to cause a pretty big tsunami that can cover a really large area, right? But there's one other source that can be really focused, and that's an undersea landslide. And there was an undersea landslide in a small bay in Alaska that caused the largest tsunami ever recorded. And, man, I'm just hesitant to throw numbers out there, but it was, if the biggest tsunami from earthquake sources is 100 feet, which is in some places in Japan was measured up to 100 feet.
100-foot tall wave?
Yeah. But really? Very, very specific circumstances. 100-foot inundation where the wave shot up a constricting valley and pushed up high and, but that's...
Oh, okay. So that,
Yeah, that's the highest.
That's different.
But that landslide tsunami in Alaska was significantly higher than that, and I forget, honestly, but it was really high. But it was very concentrated. One little bay, one little area. It didn't impact anywhere outside of
that. So it is once it starts to dissipate or spread...
Yeah.
It kind of gets within a anticipated, I don't want to say zone, but an anticipated height
or wavelength. Yeah. And I'm really glad you asked that question, though, because, we're on Cascadia, the southern end of Cascadia here from about Cape Mendocino. It goes all the way up to Vancouver Island in Canada. But the southernmost section that we're on starts right about at Oregon, and it has some very specific characteristics about it that affects like how big of a wave we can get. And every scientist that lines up on this topic will tell you that for Southern Cascadia, we cannot get a 100-foot tsunami. That no matter what they, no matter how much they let their imagination run wild with the possibility of scenarios on Cascadia, the biggest wave they can put on our beach is about 35 feet. And that's just really, that's super conservative, meaning that they've really, you know, been liberal on all the possible assumptions about how big it could be. And it's much likely going to be smaller than that.
So. Conservative and liberal in the same sentence. That's not bad.
That is funny. Yeah. Different meanings, though. Liberal, like, it's, yeah, you know, yeah. Cautious. How's that?
Yeah, fine.
I should use cautious instead of conservative.
Now, I suppose the worst case scenario would be with a king tide.
Well, the other is a gas.
And then it happens, right. So it's
on the back of a king tide.
And even then,
yeah,
you're still only talking 35 feet. So
yeah, and many people don't realize that when by the time you get to Eureka, the wave has to get over the peninsula and over the islands, and that it's not going to be that high in Eureka or in Arcata Bay. That's really right at the coast. And then we are blessed with high dunes all along our coast. They're really sort of our front line soldiers that are going to...
They're kind of buffers.
Yeah. They're going to dissipate the wave energy and try to push it back and pile the water up. And, you know, it's going to be hard for those waves to get through those dunes. Some's going to get through. I don't mean to diminish the threat, but it's just important to really have an appreciation for what your local threat is and not the threat in Japan or somewhere in Washington. And here's my analogy after the break.
Okay, 20 seconds.
Okay.
The ball is round, the ball bounces. Okay, when fine. Now we've shot it all down. Okay.
Okay.
So we'll talk about the Japanese analogy when we come back. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, Billy Joel, and the Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio, easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music, easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Troy Nicolini. Troy, before the break, you said that you were going to use an analogy about some of the different, either the slope or the tidal wave.
Yeah, it was an unrelated analogy. So we want to make sure that people prepare and are ready for, an unrelated analogy. Is that like an oxymoron?
Yeah.
I'm going off your...
That's all right.
Your body language.
You're going strong.
We want people to be aware of and prepare for the right threat for our community, right? And so it's analogous to driving on a highway. Some highways are windy and dark, and it can be raining really hard, and so you want to slow down and be cautious for that. But another day, another highway, it's straight, it's wide open, you can go 65. It makes no sense to drive 25 miles an hour on a straight, open highway in good weather that has a 65-mile-an-hour speed limit just because on some other road, doing so would be... You know, going faster would be dangerous.
Yeah,
so,
you got 36 and 80.
Yeah.
You know, one, you lock it at 80 miles an hour, and you just, you know, drive for 5 hours, and the other one, you're
exactly
not quite so much.
Yeah, so when people hear about a 100-foot wave in Japan or even bigger waves that might happen in Oregon or Washington, just remember that that is not necessarily meaningful for us here in Humboldt County.
I was going to ask you about the slope. You know, a big lagoon, it's really, you know, most of us are probably familiar with the concept of the riptide.
Yeah.
Okay. And the safety measures associated with that. But it's a pretty steep slope.
Very steep beach.
Versus like Clam Beach,
yes.
Which is, you know, you might be able to put a level on it sometimes and get the bubble within the lines. those differences, same wave, same direction, same speed, same, different beach.
What does it mean?
What would be the difference?
Yeah. That's a good question. And then the even more extreme case of flat is Humboldt Bay, right?
Okay.
The wave comes in Humboldt Bay. It travels up 7 miles of very gradually increasing elevation mud flat. So generally, that environment tends to break wave energy, which is good. It dissipates wave energy. And so that's why in Humboldt Bay, the threat from tsunamis is not nearly as severe as it is in Crescent City Harbor and Bay, where they have more vertical walls, because then the waves don't break, but instead they reflect, they bounce off. So when they bounce off, it means that they can interact with the other waves coming in and cause twice as big a wave. Yeah. So
compounding.
Compounding. Sometimes called the bathtub impact. the bathtub effect.
Little guy's toilet training, huh?
Yeah, not that long ago. When you know, you got your kid in the bathtub and they're sloshing around, the waves kind of go womp, 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 and then over the tub on the bathroom floor. Well, that's kind of what happens in Crescent City Harbor. The conditions are not right in Humboldt Bay for that to happen. It's much more likely that the first wave that comes in Humboldt Bay would travel up on the gradual beach and break, like you see waves breaking on the beach and dissipate their energy. So in general, a gradual beach provides more energy dissipation, which is good. But they're also kind of a wedge that can deliver the wave higher onto the shore. So it's kind of complicated. And then the steep beach, it depends if the... So a steep beach can cause a wave to basically kind of slap up and get higher than it would have otherwise and reach greater heights. So when Lori and I traveled to Chile, we found places that the waves seemed to get up really high, but it was one just very small areas, and you could see that the wave had actually hit like a little beach that was very steep and kind of shot up that beach and delivered some debris to a very high elevation. So it's kind of a mixed bag, and it's not straightforward.
Now, obviously, if you have a bluff, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it's going to pile up on there and get high and then reflect off and go somewhere else.
I guess kind of what you see like at Shore Acres when the waves come in and they just explode all over the rocks.
Where is Shore Acres?
Winchester.
Oh, yes, right.
And you see that great...
Exactly.
Yeah, all the calendars.
Now, that reflective potential is really intriguing to me, because in 2011, 48 hours after the tsunami struck Crescent City, another wave suddenly appeared kind of out of nowhere. And it turns out that wave was one that had bounced off of South America and traveled all the way back up to Crescent City. So the tsunami in Japan came over and hit Crescent City 9 hours later, but part of the energy went all the way down to South America. And that little hump of South America that's kind of facing up in our direction, the wave hit there, boing, bounced off, and then took this big gradual sloping curve back to Northern California and hit us 48 hours later.
And with still enough energy to
be almost a meter high, 3 feet high.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that, I don't know, I think that's really intriguing.
Well, it speaks to the power and the energy, or the amount of energy
that's
released.
And how it
things.
Can travel with such efficiency. It's like a puck on ice, like there's not much friction.
No friction.
So waves travel through the ocean with very little resistance.
What happens with a ship? You know, we know what happens when a ship's at a dock. It just gets nailed.
In deep water, they don't even notice them.
It just kind of rides it out.
Yep.
So how do the buoys then?
That's a great question. A regular wave buoy wouldn't detect the tsunami. A regular wave buoy, like the ones we use to measure the ocean waves, it's this floating device with a little, basically an accelerometer inside. And as the wave goes by and lifts the buoy up, the accelerator kind of goes, whoa, and measures that electronically and sends a signal out, right? And as the buoy drops back down, it kind of goes, it doesn't really make that sound, Brian.
But yeah.
It kind of goes, you know, whoa.
That would be a growl, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's how a regular wave buoy measures regular waves. But when a tsunami goes by one of those buoys, it doesn't notice it, because the water very gradually goes up just a few inches. And so it can't pick up the accelerations. So the way tsunamis are measured in the deep ocean is there's a buoy on top, but that's just a communications package. And then they have a sensor on the ocean floor that's measuring pressure of the water above it. And so it can notice, like, wait a minute, the total pressure just went up a little bit, figures out a tsunami went by.
So you can kind of then track it.
Exactly. And
it's coming through.
Those are called DARTs, and they're for measuring tsunamis, and they're critical for our forecasting ability. The reason why we were able to predict the arrival time and the amplitude of the waves that struck in 2011 on our coast is that a buoy off the coast of Japan measured that tsunami, and we were able to put that in the computer models and then run our forecast.
When we get the earthquakes in Alaska, different plate, different stuff going on.
Yep.
Is that why we don't necessarily have a reaction here?
You mean like those earthquakes cause an earthquake here?
Yeah, or a wave.
Or wave. Okay, no. If we have a big earthquake in Japan, we can get a really big tsunami here. Alaska. The 64 tsunami came from Alaska.
We'll talk about how that one happened when we come back.
we do as a community to make Humboldt a better place to work and live? The answer is to make sure our kids are literate, able to plan financially, move forward in their education so they are better prepared to enter our workforce, and become contributing and productive members in our society, community, and economy. How do we do it? Through the Decade of Difference Initiative. Visit decadeofdifference.org and find out how you, as a parent, student, or business owner, can help. It's the Decade of Difference. Be part of it.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time is 8:35. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with meteorologist in charge. If I say it fast enough, it comes out okay. It's when I slow down and try to get in all the letters.
It's true. Spelling the word meteorologist is not exactly trivial sometimes.
Yeah.
You have to kind of sound it out. Meteorologist.
Meet. And I just kind of stop at that point. Yeah. Talk Shop presented by CDH Painting, REDEC, American Ag Credit, and by Lolita Cheese Factory. Troy, the earthquake in 64.
Yep.
Now, I know, we've got the flood, the 64 flood. We've got the earthquake in 64 all at the same time.
All kinds
of fun stuff happening.
You forgot a really important one. I was born in 64.
In December?
In February.
Well, see, but you're old hat by then.
But I do find myself thinking, for people who, were around then, I guess I sort of was, but, wasn't really paying attention. They must have just thought, wow, this is, these two things in one year is pretty serious.
Yeah, then there's that still around the Christmas, was it
Christmas
December
flood?
22nd, December 23rd?
Yeah.
There's something about, Earthquake Day,
right?
Making it through there for Christmas. Because it's on a different plate,
mm-hmm.
and we had the earthquake, and it was a sizable earthquake, so
right.
that's a player in this dynamic also. How did that wave come down the coast rather than going out and dissipating out into the Pacific towards Hawaii and, I guess, eventually Alaska and New Zealand and the Philippines?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you look at the models that now try to hindcast what it looked like, from a modeling perspective, it turns out the plate was pointing at us. By pointing at us, I mean the plate is like a line, and there's a rupture along that line, and the wave is propagated 90 degrees from that line or orthogonally from that line, right? So that fault.
I got 90 degrees. What was the other
orthogonal
word?
Orthogonal is another, sorry.
Orthogonal
is like 90 degrees.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a $5 word.
90
isn't it?
Degrees. So that one happened to be pointing in, roughly in this direction. So lots of energy propagated down and hit this coast. A follow up question to yours that I think is always intriguing is, if anybody's been to Crescent City, that bay faces to the southwest. How did a tsunami from the north come in, wrap around, and hit Crescent City? And that's because big waves like that can bend around the coastline and actually change direction 180 degrees. That's actually, if you're in Trinidad and you see waves on the beach, it's because they're basically wrapping around the headland and coming in.
So it's almost like a whip, isn't it?
It's like a whip, yes.
So now does it come in faster, stronger? It just kind of comes
it's
in.
It's very
the
much
same.
Like a whip in that so the wave's coming down from Alaska, and the left edge of the wave hit like the Crescent City headlands, and that slows it down. Whereas the part that's still in deep water out to sea is still going fast.
So it hit like
fast.
Battery Point or whatever.
Exactly.
The
so it starts feeling that and slowing down, but the other part in the deep water is still going fast, and so it kind of wraps around and overcomes it. Much like a track runner on the outside lane. Has farther to go. That's a bad analogy. Strike that one.
I was thinking wrestling.
Yeah.
When a guy, one guy grabs and, all the energy goes into the other fellow.
Yeah.
Goes ripping around. Is that why the angles are such with the levee or the dike that was built in Crescent City, is to prevent that? Because it isn't a straight. It's a straight with an angle.
Well, it's mostly, that design is mostly to protect it from storms and from some waves coming from the southwest, yeah. In fact, there could be some retrofits of that to mitigate for tsunami to some extent, but they were deemed to be way too expensive, and tsunamis are just not that frequent enough to build for. But they
acceptable
did.
Acceptable risk, I believe, is the word.
Yes, and, for example, they did actually, when they rebuilt the harbor, they built it to withstand an event like 2011 or 2006 or even 64, but not big enough to survive a Cascadia event, because that would have been just so huge that the cost was...
The roads won't. Why should the harbor?
Yeah, there you go. That's our new slogan.
Yeah.
And that,
hey, but we got the $10 million for some of the test for the last chance grade. So hopefully.
Yes.
You know, at least
that last earthquake was it last week? No, that's all a blur. When were those two earthquakes?
You know, I was standing out in front of the studios.
Was Thursday or
couldn't feel it. I come in, everybody's running around. Earthquake! What earthquake?
I didn't feel either, but you'd never guess where I was. I was on last chance grade in a car at the moment it struck.
Down in the bottom of the dip?
Right where you're just
oh, really?
This close to sliding off into the ocean. And of course it had rained for days.
Right. It was all teed up.
The soil was nice and slippery.
Oh.
But thankfully, as you can tell by my presence, it didn't go.
Either that or your ghost is doing a pretty good job.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been a little sobering, huh?
Yeah, it was kind of funny. Because my colleague in the car about 10 minutes earlier said, wouldn't it be funny if a big earthquake hit when we're on last chance grade and then it happened? or something to that effect.
You don't want to drive with him.
No.
Yeah.
But
he gets to walk.
Yeah.
Yeah. With, you had mentioned underwater landslides.
Yeah.
Are those prevalent? Because I think the impression we have is that it's static. Okay, you get an earthquake and a couple things may kind of rumble down a little bit, but we don't think of it as like landslides or avalanches or things like that we see above the water.
Small ones happen under the seafloor all the time, and I can tell you more about those.
Okay. KINS, News and Information Times, 841. This ball has got your attention, man. The ball of time.
I know what it means.
Yes, we'll be back.
The Redwood Region Economic Development Commission and Fly Humboldt remind you that flying local is buying local and supports local jobs and investment. Fly Humboldt is a community-based coalition of businesses, organizations, and citizens dedicated to getting more flights to more destinations. We know that reliable and affordable air service is a critical part of a healthy community. For more information, visit flyhumboldt.org or find us on Facebook.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:45. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Troy Nicolini. Troy, you were talking, or we were starting to discuss underwater landslides, which I think for a lot of us doesn't really connect because we've either never seen it.
Yeah, they're not part of our daily lives.
Yeah, and landslides, you see mud ooze, you see liquefaction, you see avalanches.
Right.
You don't see underwater.
No, it's true. And folks who study this go out in the ocean and they core the seafloor and they find layers that tell them there was lots and lots of, little landslides over the years. And the way they find them is the landslide covers up the little critters crawling around on the seafloor, turbidites. They've got a rough deal there. They're crawling around merrily eating on the seafloor, and then a landslide covers them with mud. Bad for them, great for people who want to go back and figure out what's going on. So those are evident. But there's also places where you have a potential for a really big landslide, just like around here, you've got the valley in Redding, and you have the really rugged mountains here. So the sea floor is kind of the same way. So there's certain areas that are more prone to undersea landslides, and those are mapped and sort of known. Southern California has some of those scenarios where they know they could have a big undersea landslide.
Do they tend to correspond to where the plates come together also? The Rockies, obviously,
now you're getting to the geology realm that I...
Well, I'm thinking, so if it's an active fault area like we've got here, you would think that there would be a lot of up and down. But my understanding is off of our coast, there's not a lot of up and down. It's just kind of a slope.
Now I'm out on a limb, but I guess I don't mind being
out on a limb. You're under the water, nobody can tell.
No, it's true. But see, I think the process that makes the bumpiness for us is on land. That's what makes our coastal mountains. And offshore here, we have a oceanic plate that's sliding under our continental plate. And so it's a smoother plate that's going under us. But there is the big Mendocino Canyon. There is some really dramatic features.
That's true.
But we do, that's why if we have an earthquake, we're always thinking that it could be an earthquake-triggered landslide, even if the earthquake's the wrong kind of cause of tsunami, because there's the strike slips that are all in the horizontal, and they don't really cause tsunamis, but they could shake loose a landslide.
And then it's game on.
Then it's game on, yeah.
If there was an underwater landslide versus an earthquake, and the same size wave results, less time to react with an underwater landslide from the event or more time?
So it depends on where it's at. So it could be less time, though, because it could be just offshore. And it could be a big wave. So you're saying, you're thinking, Troy, give us some good news. It's going to be very focused. So it'll hit a much smaller portion of the coast, generally speaking.
Because it's close to the shore?
Because it's a smaller feature that's going to happen. Like the subduction zone we have off there reaches from, you know, basically Cape Mendocino to Vancouver Island. But a landslide would be on the order a much smaller area that would have it happen.
So maybe 2 miles rather than...
hundreds of miles, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to guess at about 800,
so
but okay.
So that's
yeah.
a good mile. That's the good news.
Okay.
And
so,
I'm glad you're talking about earthquakes because we just tested the tsunami warning system last week for the official scenario where there's an earthquake somewhere else, like Alaska or Chile or Japan. But really, the earthquake under our feet is the one we worry the most about because, you know, your radio station may not be able to broadcast. We may not be able to broadcast. So all of our official systems may be basically destroyed by the earthquake itself. So people need to react to the earthquake. That's their warning. That's Mother Nature telling them, hey, I got a tsunami coming and you need to go right now. So that's always our message we really want to always end on. Don't forget about the earthquake. That's your natural
Yeah, don't rely on somebody telling you what to do.
Yeah.
Do what you're supposed to do.
And that actually was part of the problem in Japan. They had a culture of waiting for the government to tell them whether to go or not. And so they had 40 minutes to evacuate. Many didn't because the government's earliest messages said there was not that much of a threat. They also had engineered seawalls and a culture of waiting for the official warning. So our culture is don't wait for Troy at the National Weather Service to tell you. Forget about forget about me and all my gadgets. Listen to the earthquake.
Yeah. Listen to your feet.
Yes.
Act properly. So how far up do you go? You'd mentioned a 30-foot wave, a 35-foot wave.
And generally go as far as you can, as long as you're safe and you don't get a heart attack from running up a steep hill.
Bring your binocs so you can see what's going on.
If you're at the coast, you need to get, you know, pretty far back, and you want to get up to a high bluff or inland.
Doesn't mean climb a tower.
Generally not the best thing, yeah. Like...
little radio humor at the end there.
Yeah.
All right. Apparently very little, huh? Okay.
Because you have a tower right out back.
Yeah. Okay, good. We're connecting the dots. Too bad. We're done. All right. See everybody tomorrow.